Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. Things have actually been fairly quiet on the LQ front over the last week or so. LQ Bookmarks is really gaining some traction at the new location, and it's getting far more traffic than it did while it was on the old site. And I think that it's, as I mentioned earlier, now that it's integrated into the same login as LQ, just a lot more people are tending to use it. Also, the LQ job marketplace continues to attract attention. And one great thing that's been happening here is real dialogue is going on between the job poster and the interested parties, which is great. There's at least one thread that already has over 10 responses from interested parties, and the job poster is actively participating in the thread. And like I said, that's just great to see. One thing we're interested in getting is feedback on how to promote the additional sections on LQ. And this would include sections that are part of the main site, such as the tutorials and articles, and also additional sites, such as the LQ Wiki, which now has 2,812 articles, and also LQ ISO, which as of right now has served 2,253,788 downloads and offers 360 distribution versions from over 633 mirrors. If you have any ideas on this topic, do let us know. Now, onto the news. The first story I have is Flash 9 on Linux update. This is just a quick follow-up to a story that I had covered on a previous podcast about Flash 9 on Linux. Based on a post recently made to the penguin.swf blog, it looks like things are progressing nicely now, which is great as a number of the sites that I use are now requiring Flash greater than 8. And it's kind of a pain for those of you who are regular Linux users. You know that the latest version of Flash available for Linux is currently 7. One tip that I did see, and I can't remember which site I saw it on, if you actually edit the plugins file for Firefox, you can adjust it to lie and say that you have Flash 9 installed, and that seems to work on some sites. For some reason, some sites seem to require Flash 8 or Flash 9, but not use any of the Flash 8 or 9 functionality, so it really does work in the 7 player. So that trick will work for those sites. Of course, if someone uses something that's only in Flash 9, it's not going to work, but it should get you around some sites. And whether you like Flash or not, and some people really don't like it because they kind of associate it with ads, some cool things are happening on the platform. Another post on the penguin.swf blog was extremely encouraging in that the developers seem to be testing just a ton of different distributions, and they're definitely cognizant of the fact that in Linux a lot of people use a lot of different distributions, and they are aiming basically to have a static binary that works in as many places as possible. Although they did allude to the fact that the officially supported number of distros would probably be fairly small, but their aim is for it to basically just work wherever you use it. The next story I have is Fair Use 4WM strips Windows Media DRM. It was really just a matter of time before something like this happened. Interestingly, Engadget has written an open letter to Microsoft entitled Why You Shouldn't Kill Fair Use 4WM. But I wouldn't be surprised if this one gets fixed real quick, probably even before the next Patch Tuesday hits. For regular listeners, you'll know that I'm not 100% anti-DRM, but I am anti-DRM when it's used in ways that work against consumers, which unfortunately these days is a vast majority of the time. The greed and hubris of most media companies these days is simply, in a word, appalling. They prefer that you have purchased the very same song via first LP, then tape, then CD, then PSP, then digitally. And the best part for them is, for that last one, which is digitally, you don't even really own it, you're just kind of borrowing it or leasing it from them. And not only are you just borrowing it or leasing it, in most cases, you're paying more for it than when you purchased it previously. Their costs are shrinking by leaps and bounds. The cost for them to digitally distribute music is so much lower than physically pressing CDs, yet they want to pass none of that savings on to you. What's even worse, if you use an OS such as Linux, then you can't even legitimately purchase songs via most services in the first place. It's as if they want to drive people to P2P networks so they have an excuse for failing, and fail they will if they keep up their current trends. Basically, they're learning the same lesson that Microsoft is just starting to learn. If you squeeze your customers who are legitimately trying to play by the rules to the point that those customers feel you're being predatory, In the end, they will find a way to leave. It may take a while for a viable alternative to come, especially in the case of monopolies, but it is inevitable. And if you think about it, it's really not that complicated. Give me a music service that doesn't have absurd terms of service and arbitrary limitations, and I will happily send you money. Not only that, I'll tell everyone else to do the same. In fact, if you can find a way to do DRM in a way that does not limit my legitimate use in any way, but prevents mass distribution, I could care less, to be honest. I don't want to steal. I just don't want to feel like you're stealing from me. The next story I have is Google Apps for Your Domain. On Monday, Google released Google Apps for Your Domain. This is a quote from the release page. Quote, "Now you can offer private labeled email, IM, and calendar tools to all of your users for free so they can share ideas and get things done more effectively. You can design and publish your organization's website too. It's all hosted by Google, so there's no hardware or software for you to install or maintain." End quote. So after looking at this, it's basically Gmail plus Google Talk plus Google Calendar plus Google Pages hosted at Google using your own domain. Why most articles that I've seen are calling it the Google Office Suite when it lacks a word processor, it lacks a spreadsheet, lacks a presentation program, it's absolutely beyond me. It seems people really want to see Google versus Microsoft to the point that they'll pretty much just make it up if they have to. The program is ad-supported for now, but in the future they plan on giving you the ability to pay to remove the ads and potentially add some other features. Having just made it clear that I don't consider this an office suite in any way, it's clearly a precursor to an office suite, and it obviously wouldn't surprise any of us to see Google roll their online word processor that they acquired from Writely and the spreadsheet that already exists into this in the future. In fact, it would surprise me if they didn't. It's just not that right now. If I had to guess, they're probably just waiting until those two products are a little more polished. Even then, though, this offering will not be a direct competitor to Microsoft Office, and at least not in the direct replacement sense of it. It serves a much different audience and comes with much different advantages. The real power in this, from what I can see, is the collaboration. You see, it's a real pain for small offices to share extremely simple spreadsheets. They're not using a lot of the advanced functionality that exists in Excel. What they want to do is just share a document. And there's not a lot of easy ways to do that for a very small company. That's where a product like this could really excel, and I'll admit that that pun was terrible. Before this could even be in any way potentially considered an office killer, which seems to be what everyone wants to see, Google would have to offer a version that you could host yourself, and that's not something I've seen any indication of yet. This is one of those products and spaces that I think is going to take a little while to play out. The world isn't quite ready for a mainstream online office suite yet, and the products just aren't where they need to be for that to happen. But, given some time and additional technology, this could be a space that is extremely compelling, I'm going to say in the next 18 months or so. Being able to collaboratively edit a document from anywhere in the world, from any OS, and that's including a mobile phone, is one of those paradigm-changing events that will cause major disruption. When a company can put that technology behind their firewall and allow access via VPN, that's when we'll see enterprise adoption. My guess is that it will be Google and or IBM that realizes this goal first. The next story I have is Eric Schmidt joins Apple's board of directors. Apple has recently announced that Google CEO Eric Schmidt will be joining the Apple board of directors. Now, people seem to think this will mean more support for macOS and the Google products, but it hasn't exactly worked out that way for Oracle or Intuit. And for those of you familiar with Apple, Larry Ellison and Bill Campbell have also been on the Apple board in the past. And kind of on that note, I've always found it ironic that Safari defaults to using Google for search due to a deal that Apple struck with Google, yet many Google apps either don't run at all or run fairly poorly in Safari. If I had to guess, this is more an Apple response to the Microsoft Zoom. Whatever the reasons, though, it's clear that there's a definite potential for some partnerships that benefit both companies here. And I'm thinking along the lines of Google searches for music, giving the iTunes Store as an option, being able to purchase videos from Google Video via iTunes, things of that nature. Both companies are very heavily into digital media, and without a lot of overlap of where they play in the space. This is another one of those things that should be really interesting to see where this leads about 18 months or so out. And for regular listeners, and the last story and this story are good examples, it's sure starting to look like 18 months out or so is going to be a really interesting time in the tech space. The last story I have, 10 Common Misunderstandings About the GPL. And this is from an article recently in IT Manager's Journal regarding common misunderstandings of the GPL. Well, my single bone of contention with the article is number one, which said that the GPL is not viral. The GPL most certainly is viral. Now, it's not viral in the way that they indicated in the article, and they took it to kind of an extreme where some people seem to think if you have one GPL program on your computer, everything on the computer has to be GPL'd. But saying it isn't viral when it is by design in an article meant to dispel misconceptions seems a little bit confusing to me. This article prompted me to reread the GPL FAQ, which is a little lengthy, but it is very well laid out, actually. And I have indeed cleared up some things mentally for myself, and I'll admit that I was partially prone to one of the misconceptions myself, and that was number 8, if you want to go read the article. In the end, I can see why some people choose not to use the GPL. While they claim not to be anti-commercial because you can sell GPL software, there are a couple of things in the FAQ, especially with regard to other people redistributing the product, that many or even most software companies are just not going to want to deal with. And of course, there are always loopholes, and you could kind of take the Red Hat approach and distribute your product with something like trademarked logos, which means it can't legally be simply redistributed then without ripping those out, which is basically what CentOS does with RHEL. As I was reading the FAQ, and also even the misconceptions, one thing is becoming clearer and clearer to me, and that is plenty of people, some of them well-intentioned and some of them most certainly not well-intentioned, are definitely violating the GPL. And I've come to kind of question what the actual compliant rate is, kind of looked around and I didn't see anything. There have, of course, been some successful litigations and actions against very obvious violators, but overall, it seems like, especially on the well-intentioned front, the FSF doesn't seem like they're going to sue people that are well-intentioned, but I really do wonder what the compliance rate is. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.